A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He was on a bus here in Israel and saw an ad for real estate investment. And it got him thinking. The ad itself is already interesting, because bus advertising is meant for a broad audience. This isn't a niche financial publication. It's plastered on the side of public transit for anyone stuck in traffic to see. And the message is, essentially, you too can and should become a real estate investor. Which is extremely prevalent here. Small savers are constantly encouraged to buy investment apartments. But from an investment perspective, this seems to fly in the face of every piece of personal finance advice about diversification. You're buying one asset in one market, totally exposed to that local economy.
The bus ad is the perfect entry point, because it's not just an ad, it's a thesis statement about how an entire country thinks about shelter.
A thesis statement with a phone number and a glossy rendering of a building that hasn't been built yet.
In the other room, you've got the housing policy people saying we've financialized shelter and turned homes into speculative assets. And Daniel's question ties them together. Wait, if this is bad for society and it's also bad personal finance, why is it being advertised on the side of a bus?
On the side of a bus, the investment advice equivalent of a soda ad.
And I think the place to start is that this isn't just some cultural quirk. There are structural reasons why Israelis treat real estate as the default investment vehicle. The Israeli stock market is tiny. The Tel Aviv Stock Exchange has something like 500 listed companies, and trading volume is thin. The shekel has been strong but volatile. Capital controls used to be much tighter. So for decades, the path for a middle-class family to build wealth was buy an apartment, pay it off, maybe buy a second one to rent out.
That second apartment is the key figure here. The investment apartment, which is just a second home you rent out, is a completely normalized life goal. It's not seen as a side hustle or a speculative play.
The question Daniel's asking is, why does this persist when it goes against every piece of orthodox investment advice? The standard line is diversification across asset classes, across geographies, across sectors. And the tax code has historically encouraged this. For a long time, rental income on a single residential property was completely tax-exempt up to a certain threshold, and even above that, there were favorable rates.
The Israeli investor heard that advice and decided the basket looked cozy.
So let's actually walk through the rationale, because it's not irrational in the context people are operating in. There are specific structural reasons why Israelis keep arriving at the same conclusion.
The Israeli investor who buys a second apartment in, say, Petah Tikva, now has the majority of their net worth in two pieces of real estate, both in the same country, probably within 30 kilometers of each other, exposed to the same currency, the same regulatory environment, the same geopolitical risks, the same everything.
It's about as diversified as putting your entire retirement in your cousin's sandwich shop. But here's the part that I think gets missed in the personal finance critique. Israelis know this. They're not stupid. They've seen the numbers. So why do they keep doing it? And the answer, I think, is leverage. In most developed countries, if you want to buy stocks on margin, you can maybe get 2-to-1 leverage, and you're paying high interest, and you can get margin called.
The state is actively nudging people toward this. It's not just cultural inertia.
Real estate is the one asset class where ordinary people can access massive, cheap, government-subsidized leverage. In Israel, a typical mortgage might cover 60 to 75% of the property value. So, you put down, say, 400,000 shekels, and you control an asset worth 1.5 million.
The ancestral trauma of watching your savings disappear. I get that. But we're not in the 80s anymore.
No, but inflation spiked again in 2022 and 2023, and that reactivated all those instincts. People saw prices rising and thought, I need hard assets. And the third reason is maybe the most important, leverage. It's the entire game. And in Israel specifically, property values have gone up so consistently for so long that the leverage has almost never worked against people. If you bought an apartment in central Israel in 2010 and sold it in 2025, you probably doubled or tripled your money, and on a leveraged basis, your return on equity was extraordinary.
Provided the asset goes up.
Provided it goes up. And for about 15 years, from the mid-2000s through 2022, Israeli real estate did almost nothing but go up. Prices roughly tripled in that period. There's a generational transmission of this strategy, and it's reinforced by the fact that Israel has almost no institutional rental market.
If your only experience with real estate is that it always goes up, of course you think it's a no-brainer. You'd feel foolish not participating.
In Israel, something like 70% of rental units are owned by small private landlords, individuals who own one or two investment properties. The rental market is functionally a cottage industry. That experience is going to shape your investment philosophy far more than any textbook about diversification.
Those are the structural reasons. Tax policy, inflation psychology, leverage, and a 15-year bull market that made everyone feel like a genius. But what about the diversification question specifically? Because even if all those things are true, you're still buying one asset.
This is where the Israeli version of the rationale gets creative. People will tell you, it's not really one asset, it's land, and land is finite, it's location, and location is unique. It's a rental income stream plus capital appreciation. Two different return components. Some people believe they've diversified because the apartment generates rent and might also go up in value.
That's not diversification. That's hoping the same asset does two things.
A pension fund that owns 5,000 apartments has an incentive to keep tenants happy because vacancy is expensive and turnover costs money and reputation matters. A dentist who owns one investment apartment has almost the opposite incentive. Every month they keep the same tenant, the rent is probably below market because they haven't raised it, and they're almost certainly losing money relative to what they could get if they relet the unit.
It's like saying you've diversified your diet because you eat both the pizza and the crust.
That's a beautiful image. And there's another layer. Many Israeli investors buy off-plan. They commit to an apartment that hasn't been built yet, putting down payments over several years. They're not just concentrated in one asset class. The small landlord's mental model is not, I run a housing business. It's, I own an asset that should be generating maximum yield. And that distinction is everything. A business owner thinks about customer retention.
The pre-sale market here is wild. I've seen people put down 20% on an apartment that's a hole in the ground and a sales office with renderings.
Those renderings always show happy families walking through sun-dappled parks that will be, in reality, a dusty lot for 3 more years. But people buy the dream. And here's the thing, for many Israelis, this isn't actually an investment in the way a financial advisor would use the word. It's a forced savings mechanism. If you have money in a brokerage account, you can sell with a few clicks. It's liquid. Temptation is always there. But an apartment is illiquid. You can't impulsively sell it to fund a vacation. This is exactly what political scientists call the policy feedback loop. The structure of the market creates a constituency with a vested interest in preserving that structure. If you tried to introduce German-style rent controls in Israel, you'd face opposition not just from developers and big capital, but from hundreds of thousands of small landlords who vote.
That's simultaneously clever and slightly sad. You're essentially paying a premium in transaction costs, in concentration risk, in illiquidity, for the privilege of protecting yourself from your own impulses.
Those transaction costs are enormous. Purchase tax on an investment apartment in Israel is 8%. That's before you've made a single shekel of return. You're starting 8% in the hole. It's voter registration for the property owner class. And once you're in that class, your interests shift.
To even break even, the property needs to appreciate significantly. That's a high hurdle.
It's a very high hurdle. And it's one that most small investors don't fully calculate. They see the headline price, they see what their neighbor sold for, and they don't subtract all the friction. The net return, when you account for everything, is often much lower than people imagine.
It's a speculative position dressed up as a prudent investment, subsidized by their day job.
There was a Bank of Israel report a few years ago that looked at the actual returns on investment apartments, properly accounting for all costs. mortgage interest, maintenance, property tax, vacancies, agent fees, and the net yield was often 2 to 3%. In some cases, negative.
Start with prices.
Prices get pushed up. That's the most obvious effect. Investors compete with owner-occupiers for the same limited housing stock. But investors have different incentives. Behavioral economics would have a field day with this. Mental accounting, loss aversion, the endowment effect, you name the bias, Israeli real estate investors are exhibiting it. They treat the mortgage principal as savings rather than debt service. They ignore the opportunity cost of their down payment. That 400,000 shekels could have been in a diversified portfolio compounding at 7%.
The investor can outbid the family that actually wants to live there.
And in markets where this is widespread, you get a self-reinforcing cycle. Investors bid up prices, which makes homeownership less attainable for first-time buyers, which pushes more people into the rental market, which increases rental demand, which increases rental yields, which attracts more investors, round and round.
The cycle feeds itself. Homeownership becomes harder, so you rent, and your rent payments are funding someone else's investment property, which makes it even harder for you to save for a deposit.
In a healthy housing market, small landlords can play a useful role. They can provide housing in niches that institutional investors ignore. They can be more responsive to local conditions. They can maintain properties with genuine care because they're personally invested in the neighborhood. The classic example is the owner-occupied duplex or triplex, someone who lives in one unit and rents out the others.
The landlords they're paying are often not professional property companies with portfolios and management systems. They're individuals who own one or two apartments.
And this is the second effect, the quality of the rental stock and the rental experience. Small-time landlords are often undercapitalized. They've stretched to buy the property. It's remarkably effective. But that's not what's happening in Israel. The typical Israeli investment apartment is owned by someone who lives across town or in a different city entirely and visits the property maybe twice a year. They're not part of the community. They're not responsive. They're an absentee owner whose only interaction with the asset is checking the bank transfer on the first of the month.
The question becomes, can you design policy that encourages the good kind of small landlord while discouraging the bad kind? Or is the whole category too messy to regulate at that granularity?
Some countries have tried. The Netherlands, before some recent reforms, had a points-based system for rent control that applied to most of the market, and small landlords operated within that framework. They could make reasonable returns, but not extractive ones.
You get worse housing outcomes for renters, and you also get price inflation that locks people out of ownership. That's two strikes.
In both cases, the key is that the rules of the game are set by policy, not by individual landlord discretion. The small landlord can exist, but they're not a mini-sovereign over their rental unit. So, you get a glut of three-room and four-room apartments in areas with high investment demand, and a shortage of larger family-sized units, or housing in peripheral areas where owner-occupiers might want to live, but investors see less upside.
And because the market is so tight, vacancy rates in central Israel are basically zero. Tenants have almost no bargaining power.
This is where the bus ad becomes genuinely pernicious. It's not just encouraging people to make a questionable investment decision. It's encouraging them to join a system that extracts value from renters while providing minimal professional service in return. The ad is saying, come be a mini sovereign.
Here's where I want to push back a little. Isn't there an argument that small investors provide rental housing that wouldn't otherwise exist? If professional developers only build for sale housing, who's providing the rental stock?
That's a fair question. And historically, small landlords have been the backbone of rental markets in many countries. Let me push back on myself for a second, though. I've been pretty harsh on small landlords here, but I want to be fair. A lot of them didn't set out to become mini-sovereigns.
The dose makes the poison.
They looked at the pension system, which in Israel is actually pretty decent now with mandatory contributions, but for decades it wasn't. And they looked at the cost of living, and they looked at the stock market, and real estate was the path that made sense within the system they were given. The bus ad isn't creating the demand out of thin air. It's responding to a genuine anxiety about financial security in a country where everything feels precarious. The problem arises when small investors become the dominant source of rental housing, and when the policy framework actively encourages that at the expense of other models.
The villain is the structure. The tax incentives, the planning policies, the absence of institutional rental housing. The cultural narrative that renting is throwing money away, and ownership is the only path to dignity. The bus ad is a symptom.
Symptoms can make the disease worse.
Is there a version of this that actually benefits society? Daniel's second question.
It's a trap.
Let's talk about the institutional investor piece, because I think it's the missing alternative that makes the whole critique land. Why aren't pension funds and REITs and professional landlords entering the Israeli rental market at scale?
First, the regulatory framework for large-scale rental housing in Israel is still relatively new and untested. The government has tried to encourage it. There was a push a few years ago for rental housing for the long term, with tax breaks for institutional landlords who commit to 20-year rental periods.
Most small investors aren't doing that. They're buying an existing apartment that someone else would have bought to live in.
If you're a global pension fund looking at cap rates, you can get better returns in the US or Europe with less regulatory uncertainty. If the investor buys in a lower cost area, does modest renovations, and charges below market rent to long-term tenants, that's a social good. It's a completely backwards equilibrium. In a normal market, professionals can accept lower yields because they have lower costs of capital, economies of scale, and efficient operations.
The mensch landlord.
Israel has somehow inverted this. Amateurs accept low yields because they're not calculating them properly and they're betting on capital gains, while professionals stay away because the actual risk-adjusted returns don't pencil out. If your apartment has doubled in value, the rental yield on your original purchase price looks great, but the yield on current market value looks terrible. With their day job income, in many cases, they're effectively providing below-market rental housing while losing money on a cash flow basis. And the only thing that makes it work is the assumption of perpetual capital appreciation.
Which is the gentrification engine in a nutshell.
The third pathway is the most interesting to me and the most speculative. What a small-scale investment were structured as a genuine community-building mechanism. Not exactly the same structure, but we've seen versions of it. Ireland after 2008, a lot of small buy-to-let investors got crushed when property prices fell and rents dropped, and they were left with mortgages they couldn't service.
Instead of one person owning one apartment and extracting maximum rent, you have a cooperative that owns several properties and manages them for the benefit of the community.
The investment is still real estate, but the governance structure changes everything. Decisions about rent levels, about who gets priority for units, about reinvestment in the properties. Those are made collectively, with community interests in mind, not just return maximization. That's the macro dimension that gets almost no attention in Israeli public discourse, the financial stability risk.
That sounds great. It also sounds like something that requires a level of social cohesion and trust that most places don't have.
But flagging is not the same as doing something about it, so you'd need policy changes to make this viable at scale.
We are back to policy. The individual investor responding to that bus ad isn't thinking about community land trusts or housing supply elasticity. They're thinking, I need to secure my future, and this is what people like me do.
The exact people the bus ads were targeting. The dentists and teachers and retirees who were told this was the safe, prudent path to financial security. It's the visible tip of an entire system. A set of policies, cultural assumptions, and economic incentives that have made real estate the default answer to the question, what should I do with my savings?
Let me ask you something. If you were advising someone, not a policymaker, just an ordinary person who saw that bus ad and is thinking about buying an investment property, what would you tell them?
When you treat shelter as primarily an investment asset, you get what Israel has. Some of the highest home price-to-income ratios in the developed world, a rental market that provides no stability, and a generation of young people who cannot form households without parental assistance, periods of vacancy between tenants, repairs and maintenance, mortgage interest, which, by the way, is not fully deductible for investment properties in Israel the way it is in some countries.
They're undiversified across something even more fundamental. Their human capital and their investment capital are correlated. If you live and work in Israel, your salary is already exposed to the Israeli economy.
That's the big one. If you put that same down payment into a diversified portfolio of low-cost index funds, and I know this sounds boring compared to owning real estate, what would the historical return look like? This is what finance people call the double exposure problem. Your labor income and your investment returns are both tied to the same underlying economy. A properly diversified portfolio would have assets that are uncorrelated with your local labor market, international stocks, global bonds, assets denominated in other currencies.
The leaky pipe as systemic risk?
I'm serious. One bad tenant, one major repair, one regulatory change, and your concentrated bet can go very wrong. Most small investors don't adequately price that tail risk.
Here's the thing. People don't make decisions based on spreadsheets. They make decisions based on stories. And the story of Israeli real estate is incredibly powerful. The balcony is doing a lot of work in Israeli real estate marketing. Show a balcony. Imply a lifestyle. Ignore the mortgage-to-income ratio.
There's actually an interesting behavioral dimension here that I want to flag. Real estate feels safer than stocks because you can touch it. It's physical. It doesn't disappear when the market closes. You can drive past it.
Whereas I bought a place in Florentine before it was cool, and now it's worth triple. That's a story you tell at every family gathering for the rest of your life.
People systematically underestimate the risk of real estate because it feels solid and permanent, and they systematically overestimate the risk of financial assets because they feel abstract and ephemeral. So the narrative remains overwhelmingly positive.
We've got a system where policy pushes people toward real estate. Culture reinforces it. The stories people tell make it seem like a sure thing, and the actual numbers, when you run them properly, are often less impressive than they appear. That's quite a trap.
The trap has societal consequences. We've talked about price inflation, about rental quality, about misallocation of housing stock, but there's another dimension. It's an asset class that's uniquely good at letting you lie to yourself. And the entire ecosystem, the mortgage banks, the real estate agents, the developers, the bus advertisers, benefits from maintaining that comfortable self-deception.
Let's pivot to the normative question. Daniel asks whether there's a way this form of investing can be beneficial to society. I think we've been pretty negative so far. Is there a positive case?
I think there is, but it requires reimagining what small-scale real estate investment looks like. The positive case is something like small landlords who are part of the community they're renting in, who provide well-maintained housing, who offer stable leases, who see their tenants as long-term partners rather than temporary yield sources.
The NIMBY phenomenon, but with a financial gun to your head.
When enough voters are in that position, you get a political equilibrium where it's very hard to build enough housing to bring prices down. And I think policies should be designed to encourage that model and discourage the absentee yield-chasing model.
Usually, the concentrated interest wins over the diffuse interest. But here, the concentrated interest is the investor class, and they're blocking the diffuse interests of everyone who needs affordable housing.
You're not trying to eliminate the small landlord. You're trying to select for the kind that adds value to the community. People who are not wealthy by any global standard, but who have managed to scrape together a down payment. They're not villains. They're responding rationally to the incentives they've been given.
Which makes the politics of fixing this incredibly thorny. You're not fighting some cartoonish developer villain. You're fighting your uncle who bought an apartment in Petah Tikva and is counting on it for his retirement.
But no individual actor can get there alone. The small landlord can't unilaterally offer a stable long-term lease if they're worried about being stuck with below-market rent.
What breaks the cycle? Is there a way out?
I think there are a few possible paths, none of them easy. One is a gradual shift in tax policy, reducing the advantages for investment properties while increasing them for owner-occupied housing. You don't have to punish investors. The flywheel has real human costs. I'm thinking about the data on housing insecurity in Israel. Something like 30% of renters move every 2 years or less, often involuntarily. That's not just an inconvenience.
That would require a government willing to take on a very popular set of tax breaks.
And a significant driver of that churn is the small landlord dynamic we've been describing. The constant pressure to raise rents, the refusal to offer multi-year leases, the incentive to turnover. The planning system is Byzantine. Land allocation is controlled by the Israel Land Authority, which moves at a pace that makes glaciers look hasty. The market keeps going up, so the reset is always upward. It's a ratchet.
Let me ask you something. If you were designing a housing market from scratch, knowing everything we know about incentives and behavioral biases and systemic risk, would you allow individuals to own rental properties at all?
The third path is a cultural shift. That's a hard question. I think I'd allow it, but with guardrails. The owner-occupied multi-unit model is too valuable to lose. And there are genuine cases. Someone inherits a property, someone moves temporarily and rents out their home, someone builds an accessory dwelling unit, where small-scale renting makes sense and does no harm.
They happen slowly, and usually after a crisis.
That's the fourth and least pleasant path. A market correction. If prices fall significantly, and this has happened in other countries after long booms, the one-way bet psychology shatters. The bus ad is the crystallization of all of it. A 30-second pitch, visible from your car window, telling you that the path to financial security is to buy a piece of someone else's housing and charge them for it.
Covering the rent with someone else's rent.
That's the dream they're selling. And it works because it has worked for a specific generation in a specific market under specific conditions that may not hold. The question is whether it will keep working for the next generation or whether they're being sold a product that peaked 20 years ago.
The bus ad is basically selling the past to the future.
The past had different demographics, different interest rates, different starting prices. You can't replicate the experience of someone who bought in 1995 by buying in 2026. The math doesn't work.
I want to circle back to something. You mentioned Australia and Canada as having similar dynamics. Are there lessons from those markets about what happens when the small investor model reaches its logical conclusion?
Both are cautionary tales. In Australia, negative gearing, which is the ability to deduct rental losses from your taxable income, created a massive class of small investors who were effectively subsidized by the tax system to bid up housing prices. Let me bring in one more dimension before we wrap. There's a geopolitical angle here that's specific to Israel and that I think subtly reinforces the real estate obsession.
The political trap is the same.
There's a deep cultural resonance to owning a piece of the ground that goes beyond financial calculation. When you buy an apartment in Israel, you're not just making an investment. You're participating in a multi-generational project of territorial presence. Now they're dealing with a situation where a significant portion of the condo stock is owned by investors who are facing higher interest rates and negative cash flow.
Negative cash flow means the rent doesn't cover the mortgage and expenses.
The investment apartment is a financial instrument, but it's also a stake in the ground, literally and metaphorically. But if prices stall or fall, you're bleeding cash for an asset that's losing value. It's a terrible position to be in.
We're seeing that in Israel now, with interest rates having risen.
Interest rates in Israel went up significantly in 2022 and 2023, though they've come down somewhat since. But mortgage rates are still much higher than they were during the era of near zero rates. An investor who bought with a variable rate mortgage has seen their monthly payments increase substantially. The rental income that looked adequate at 2% interest looks very different at 5 or 6%.
There's a squeeze happening right now.
They're middle-class families stretching to buy a second property because they've been told it's the responsible thing to do. If the market turns, they're the ones who get hurt. Every month that rates stay elevated, more investors are running the numbers and realizing they're losing money on a cash flow basis.
That's when the stories start to change.
That's when the stories change. The bus ads, by the way, are still running. The developers still need to sell. So the marketing continues even as the economics get shakier. That gap between the glossy rendering and the financial reality, that's where a lot of people are living right now.
Living might be a generous term. Existing in the gap.
So, to answer the prompt directly, because we've ranged wide and I want to make sure we deliver what was asked. Hilbert, I don't know what to do with that. It's not completely irrational given the incentives, but it carries concentration risk that most people dramatically underestimate.
The societal impact.
The proliferation of small-time investors harms the broader market in several concrete ways. It pushes up prices by adding investor demand to already constrained supply. It fragments ownership in ways that make rental housing worse and building maintenance harder. It distorts what gets built toward investor preferences rather than resident needs. And it creates a political constituency that opposes the very supply increases that would make housing more affordable.
The bus ad is a symptom of a market that's organized around investors rather than residents.
And until the policy framework changes, until the tax code stops favoring real estate over other investments, until the planning system allows enough building to meet demand, until the cultural narrative shifts. Those bus ads will keep running, and people will keep stretching to buy apartments they can barely afford, convinced they're making the smart financial move.
The smart financial move that, for enough people, will turn out not to have been so smart. And even for those who do okay, the collective cost in affordability, in housing quality, in political gridlock is enormous.
There's an irony here. Real estate is the most tangible investment. You can see it, touch it, walk through it. And that tangibility makes it feel safer than a brokerage statement. But the safety is largely an illusion. The risks are just different. Less visible, slower to materialize, but no less real.
The illusion of solid ground.
Until it isn't.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1886, a Russian expedition in the Pamir Mountains of Tajikistan discovered a near-complete manuscript of the lost Sogdian epic, The Tale of the Red Camel, in a cave monastery above the Bartang Valley. The manuscript survived only because a monk had used its pages as lining for a grain storage chest. The expedition's linguist died of altitude sickness before he could translate it, and the manuscript was misplaced in a St. Petersburg archive until 1973.
A grain chest? That's some archival strategy.
Lost, found, lost again, and rediscovered. The manuscript's journey was almost as epic as the tale itself. This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.